time on a Saturday night. These circuits and systems, writes a leading neuroscientist and addiction researcher, Professor Jaak Pansep, must serve some critical purpose other than promoting the vigorous intake of highly purified chemical compounds recently developed by humans. Addiction may not be a natural state, but the brain regions it subverts are part of our central machinery of survival. I catch myself edging into a trap here. By writing that addiction subverts the brain, I realize I'm feeding the impression that addiction has a life of its own, like a virus invading the body, a predator ready to pounce, or a foreign agent infiltrating an unsuspecting host country. In reality, the constellation of behaviors we call addiction is provoked by a complex set of neurological and emotional mechanisms that develop inside a person. These mechanisms have no separate existence and no conscious will of their own, even if the addict may often experience himself as governed by a powerful controlling force or as suffering from a disease he has no strength to resist. So it would be more accurate to say, addiction may not be a natural state, but the brain regions in which its powers arise are central to our survival. The force of the addiction process stems from that very fact. Here's an analogy. Let's say the section of someone's brain that controls body movements, the motor cortex, was damaged or did not develop properly. That person would inevitably have some kind of physical impairment. If the affected nerves managed nothing more than the motions of the little toe, any loss would hardly be noticeable. If, however, the damaged or undeveloped nerves governed the activity of a leg, the person would have a significant disability. In other words, the impairment would be proportional to the size and importance of the malfunctioning brain center. So it is with addiction. There is no addiction center in the brain, no circuits designated strictly for addictive purposes. The brain systems involved in addiction are among the key organizers and motivators of human emotional life and behavior. Hence, addiction's powerful hold on human beings. Three major networks are involved. We'll look at the opioid apparatus in the rest of this chapter, and in chapters 15 and 16, respectively, the dopamine system, which performs incentive motivation functions, and the self-regulation system in the cortex, or gray matter. The defining molecules of the opioid apparatus are the brain's natural narcotics, the endorphins. It was in the 1970s that an innate opioid system was first identified in the mammalian brain. The protein molecules that serve as the chemical messengers in this system were named endorphins by the U.S. researcher Eric Simon, because they are endogenous, they originate within the organism, and because they bear resemblance to morphine. Morphine and its opiate cousins fit into the brain's endorphin receptors, and thus, to quote a textbook on addiction research, the main endorphin receptor represents the molecular gate for opioid addiction. Humans are not the only creatures who have an innate opiate system. We share this pleasure with our near and distant relatives on the evolutionary ladder. Even one-celled organisms produce endorphins. Not surprisingly, endorphins do for us exactly what plant-derived opioids can do. They're powerful soothers of pain, both physical and emotional. They grant, in the words of that opiate disciple Thomas De Quincey, serenity, equipoise, the removal of any deep-seated irritation. For the distracted and soul-suffering person, a hit of endorphins, just like an infusion of opium products, composes what has been agitated, concentrates what has been distracted. Beyond their soothing properties, endorphins serve other functions essential to life. They're important regulators of the autonomic nervous system, the part that's not under our conscious control. They affect many organs in the body, from the brain and the heart to the intestines. They influence mood changes, physical activity, and sleep, and regulate blood pressure, heart rate, breathing, bowel movements, and body temperature. They even help modulate our immune system. Endorphins are the chemical catalysts for our experience of key emotions that make human life or any other mammalian life possible. Most crucially, they enable the emotional bonding between mother and infant. When the natural opioid receptor systems of infant lab animals have been genetically knocked out, they're unable to experience secure connection with their mothers. They're less distressed when separated from the mother, and this means they can't give her the signals she needs to act as their nurturer and protector. It's not that they can't feel discomfort or fear. They do when exposed to cold or to danger signals, such as male mouse odors. But without opioid receptors, they can't maintain the relationship with their mother on whom their survival depends. They show no interest in their mother's cues. Imagine the peril they would face if they acted indifferently to their mother in the wild. Conversely, young animals, dogs, chicks, rats, and monkeys, who experience separation anxiety on being isolated from their mothers, can be soothed by small, non-sedating doses of opiates. Endorphins have been well described as molecules of emotion. The role of endorphins in human feelings was illustrated by an imaging study of 14 healthy women volunteers. Their brains were scanned while they were in a neutral emotional state, and then again when they were asked to think of an unhappy event in their lives. 10 of them recalled the death of a loved one, 3 remembered breakups with boyfriends, and 1 focused on a recent argument with a close friend. Using a special tracer chemical, the scan highlighted the activity of opioid receptors in the emotional centers of each participant's brain. While the women were under the spell of sad memories, these receptors were much less active. On the other hand, positive expectations turn on the endorphin system. Scientists have observed, for example, that when people expect relief from pain, the activity of opioid receptors will increase. Even the administration of inert medications, substances that do not have direct physical activity, will light up opioid receptors, leading to decreased pain perception. This is the so-called placebo effect, which, far from being imaginary, is a genuine physiological event. The medication may be inert, but the brain is soothed by its own painkillers, the endorphins. Opiate receptors can be found throughout the body, and in each organ, they play a specific role. In the nervous system, they are tranquilizers and painkillers, but in, say, the gut, their role is to slow down muscle contractions. In the mouth, they diminish secretions. This is why narcotics taken for pain relief will cause unwanted side effects elsewhere in the body, such as constipation or a dry mouth. Why should there be so many different tasks for one class of natural chemicals? Because nature, that thrifty homemaker, likes to preserve what is tried and true and to find as many uses as possible for each type of messenger protein. As evolution progressed, systems and substances that had a relatively narrow function in simpler organisms found new arenas of activity in the higher, more complex species that emerged. Many other body chemicals serve multiple purposes, and the more evolved the organisms, the more functions a particular substance will have. This is true even of genes. In one type of cell, a certain gene will serve one function. Elsewhere in the body, it will be assigned quite a different duty. In his book, Effective Neuroscience, Dr. Jaak Pansep gives a fascinating example of the role played in reptiles by vasopressin, a primitive version of the protein oxytocin, which triggers labor contractions and breastfeeding in female mammals. Vasopressin is an ancient brain molecule that controls sexual urges in reptiles. This same molecule also helps deliver reptilian young into the world. When a sea turtle, after thousands of miles of migration, lands on its ancestral beach and begins to dig its nest, an ancient bonding system comes into action. Vasopressin levels in the mother turtle's blood begin to rise as she digs a pit large enough to receive scores of eggs, and reach even higher levels as she deposits one egg after the other. With her labors finished, she covers the eggs while circulating vasopressin diminishes to insignificant levels. Her maternal responsibilities fulfilled, she departs on another long sea journey. Mammalian mothers do not get off so easily. They stay with their helpless young. And oxytocin, a more sophisticated version of vasitocin, plays a much more diverse role than its reptilian counterpart. It not only induces labor, but also affects a mother's moods and promotes her physical and emotional nurturing of infants. In mammals of both sexes, oxytocin also contributes to orgasmic pleasure, and more generally, may be considered one of the love hormones. Just like opioids, oxytocin can reduce separation anxiety when infused into distressed young animals. Significantly, oxytocin also interacts with opioids. It is not an endorphin, but it increases the sensitivity of the brain's opioid systems to endorphins, nature's way of making sure that we don't develop a tolerance to our own opiates. Remember that tolerance is the process by which an addict no longer feels the benefit of previously enjoyable doses of a drug and has to seek more and more. Why is it essential to prevent tolerance to our natural reward chemicals? Because opioids are necessary for parental love. The infant's well-being would be jeopardized if the mother became insensitive to the effects of her own opioids. Nurturing mothers experience major endorphin surges as they interact lovingly with their babies. Endorphin highs can be one of the natural rewards of motherhood. Given the many thankless tasks required in infant and child care, nature took care to give us something to enjoy about parenting. Tolerance would more than rob us of those pleasures. It would threaten the infant's very existence. It would be disastrous, writes Professor Panksepp, if mothers lost their ability to feel intense social gratification from nurturance when children were still quite young. By making our brain cells more sensitive to opioids, oxytocin allows us to remain hooked on our babies. Opiates, in other words, are the chemical linchpins of the emotional apparatus in the brain that is responsible for protecting and nurturing infant life. Thus, addiction to opiates like morphine and heroin arises in a brain system that governs the most powerful emotional dynamic in human existence, the attachment instinct, love. Attachment is the drive for physical and emotional closeness with other people. It ensures infant survival by bonding infant to mother and mother to infant. Throughout life, the attachment drive impels us to seek relationships and companionship, maintains family connections, and helps build community. When endorphins lock onto opiate receptors, they trigger the chemistry of love and connection, helping us to be the social creatures we are. It may seem puzzling that nature would have given one class of chemicals the apparently very different tasks of alleviating physical pain, easing emotional pain, creating parent-infant bonds, maintaining social relationships, and triggering feelings of intense pleasure. In fact, the five roles are closely allied. Opiates do not take away pain. Instead, they reduce our consciousness of it as an unpleasant stimulus. Pain begins as a physical phenomenon, registered in the brain, but we may or may not consciously notice it at any given moment. What we call being in pain is our subjective experience of that stimulus, i.e., ouch, that hurts, and our emotional reaction to the experience. Opiates help make some pain bearable. It has been suggested, for example, that high levels of endorphins help toddlers endure the many bumps and minor bruises they sustain on their rambunctious adventures. It's not that a toddler's injuries don't cause pain. They do. But partly because of endorphins, the pain isn't enough to discourage him. Without a high level of endorphins, he might even want to stop his explorations of the world, so necessary for learning and development. A child who complains bitterly of the slightest hurt and is often accused of being a crybaby is probably low on endorphins and is likely to be less adventurous than his peers. Anatomically, physical pain is registered in one part of the brain, the thalamus, but its subjective impact is experienced in another part, the anterior cingulate cortex, or ACC. The brain gets the pain message in the thalamus, but feels it in the ACC. This latter area lights up, or is activated, when we are reacting to the pain stimulus. And it's in the cortex, the ACC and elsewhere, that opiates help us endure the pain by reducing not its physical, but its emotional impact. A recent imaging study showed that the ACC also lights up when people feel the pain of social rejection. The brains of healthy adult volunteers were scanned as they were mentally participating in a game and then suddenly excluded. Even this mild and obviously artificial rejection lit up the ACC and caused feelings of hurt. In other words, we feel physical and emotional pain in the same part of the brain, and that, in turn, is crucial to our bonding with others who are important to us. In normal circumstances, the emotional pain of separation keeps us close to each other when we most need that closeness. Why did nature make the mammalian opioid system responsible for our reaction to both physical and emotional pain? For a very good reason. The complete helplessness of the young mammal and its absolute dependence on nurturing adults. Physical pain is a danger alarm. If a child wakes up with a tummy ache, her ACC goes into overdrive, and she'll give every possible signal to call her caregivers promptly to her side. For the infant mammal, emotional pain is an equally essential warning. It alerts us to the danger of separation from those we depend on for our very lives. Feeling this emotional pain triggers infant behaviors, ultrasonic vocalization in rat pups, pitiful crying in human babies, designed to bring the parent back. The attentive presence of the nurturing adult will trigger endorphin release in the infant's brain, helping to soothe her. A child can also feel emotional distress when their parent is physically present but emotionally unavailable. Even adults know that kind of pain when someone important to us is bodily present but psychologically absent. This is the state the seminal researcher and psychologist Alan Shore has called proximal separation. Given that the child's dependence is as much emotional as physical, in normal circumstances, a child who senses emotional separation will seek to reconnect with the parent. Once more, the parent's loving response will flood the brain with endorphins and ease the child's discomfort. Should the parent not respond, or not respond adequately, endorphins won't be released, and the child will be left to his own inadequate coping mechanisms, for example, rocking or thumb-sucking as ways of self-soothing, or tuning out to escape his distress. Children who have not received the attentive presence of the parent are, as we will see, at greater risk for seeking chemical satisfaction from external sources later in life. In keeping with nature's efficient, multipurpose recycling of chemical substances, endorphins are also responsible for experiences of pleasure and joyful excitement. Like infants and mothers, lovers, spiritual seekers, and bungee jumpers, yes, bungee jumpers, all reach euphoric states in which endorphins play a key role. One study found that endorphin levels tripled in the blood of bungee jumpers for the half hour following the leap, and were correlated with the degree of reported euphoria. The higher the endorphin levels, the greater the euphoric feelings. While the brain's opiate receptors are the natural template for feelings of reward, soothing, and connectedness, they are also triggered by narcotic drugs, and they play a role in other addictions too. In a study of alcoholics, opioid receptor activity was diminished in several brain regions, and this was associated with increased alcohol craving. The activation of opioid pathways and the resulting increased endorphin activity also enhances cocaine's effects. As with alcohol, less endorphin activity means a greater desire for cocaine. Activation of opiate receptors contributes to the pleasures of marijuana use as well. In short, the life foundational opioid love, pleasure, pain relief apparatus provides the entry point for narcotic substances into our brains. The less effective our own internal chemical happiness system is, the more driven we are to seek joy or relief through drug taking or through other compulsions we perceive as rewarding. The very essence of the opiate high was expressed by a 27-year-old sex trade worker. She had HIV and has since died. "The first time I did heroin," she said to me, "it felt like a warm, soft hug." In that phrase, she told her life story and summed up the psychological and chemical cravings of all substance-dependent addicts. Chapter 15. Cocaine, Dopamine, and Candy Bars: The Incentive System in Addiction. Lisa stands in the middle of my office and lifts her blouse to show the scattered red rash covering her abdomen, chest, and back. Her body jerks around like a rigid puppet. In the crook of her right elbow, she cradles a giant plastic bottle of orange drink as she would a baby or a doll. With her left hand, she pulls at her hair. Although she's 24 years old, Lisa is so emotionally immature and physically childlike that often when I see her, I think she belongs at home playing with dolls rather than here in the downtown East Side. Today, her restless movements make her look even more childlike than usual. Her short stature, large eyes, and puffy cheeks smeared with mascara and dried tears give her the look of an adolescent girl caught playing with her mother's makeup. She's high on cocaine.
"I've had this rash for 3 days. What is it, Doc?"
I ask her to sit so I can inspect her hands and feet. She pulls off her dirty white socks. The little red dots are visible on her palms and soles as well. "I'm afraid it's syphilis," I tell her. "You'll need a blood test." In 20 years of family practice, I never saw one case of syphilis. Here in the downtown East Side, it's diagnosed regularly. As Lisa leaps to her feet, the plastic bottle clatters to the floor, spilling its contents.
"How can it be syphilis?" she exclaims in a voice that mixes childish surprise with complaint. "I thought that was a sexual disease."
"It is."
"But can you get it when the guy just comes on your pussy?"
For a moment, her naivete leaves me at a loss for words. "Who was your partner?" I ask. "He ought to be tested as well."
"How should I know, Doc? It was in an alley. I was looking for coke money. It was the day before Welfare Wednesday, and I couldn't wait anymore."
Many addicts have told me that cocaine is a tougher taskmaster than heroin, harder to escape. Although it doesn't cause physical withdrawal symptoms nearly as distressing, the psychological drive to use it seems more difficult to resist, even after it no longer gives much pleasure. Cocaine increases brain levels of the neurotransmitter dopamine by blocking it from being transported back into the nerve cells that release it. Recall that all drugs work by locking into receptor sites on cell surfaces. Cocaine's effects wear off very quickly because it occupies its receptor sites for only a brief time. The urge to use, to get the next dopamine hit, then redoubles. Like other stimulant drugs, speed, nicotine, and caffeine, cocaine taps directly into a brain system that in its own way is just as powerful as the opioid attachment reward system described in the previous chapter. It plays a key role in all substance addictions and also in behavioral addictions. There is an area in the midbrain which, when triggered, gives rise to intense feelings of elation or desire. It's called the ventral tegmental apparatus, or VTA. When researchers insert electrodes into the VTA of lab rats, and the animals are given a lever that allows them to stimulate this brain center, they'll do so to the point of exhaustion. They ignore food and pain just so they can reach the lever. Human beings may also endanger themselves in order to continue self-triggering this brain area. One human subject
stimulated himself 1,500 times in a 3-hour period, to the point that he was experiencing an almost overwhelming euphoria and elation, and had to be disconnected despite his vigorous protests. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter chiefly responsible for the power of the VTA and its associated network of brain circuits. Nerve fibers from the VTA trigger dopamine release in a brain center that plays a central role in all addictions, the nucleus accumbens, or NA, located on the underside of the front of the brain. Sudden increases in dopamine levels in the nucleus accumbens set off the initial excitement and elation experienced by drug users. And this is also what rats and people are after when they keep pushing those levers. All abusable substances raise dopamine in the NA, stimulants like cocaine most dramatically. As in the case of the opioid apparatus, nature did not design the VTA, the NA, or other parts of the brain's dopamine system just so the addicts and drug users of the world could feel happier or more energized and focused. Indeed, the human brain's dopamine circuits are no less important to survival than its opioid system. If opioids help consummate our reward-seeking activities by giving us pleasure, dopamine initiates these activities in the first place. It also plays a major role in the learning of new behaviors and their incorporation into our lives. Along with its connections in the forebrain and the cortex, the VTA thus forms the neurological basis of another major brain system involved in the addiction process, the incentive motivation apparatus. This system responds to reinforcement, and reinforcers all have the effect of increasing dopamine levels in the nucleus accumbens. Let's take a hypothetical situation involving a hypothetical you. You see a chocolate bar in a Halloween bag, and you're seized by a desire to munch on it. A classic example of a positively reinforced behavior. That is, you've tasted a similar chocolate bar before and liked the experience. Now, when this new bar appears in your sight, dopamine is released in the NA, inciting you to take a bite. Your 4-year-old daughter, to whom the bar belonged, accuses you of thieving. "The dopamine made me do it," you say in self-defense. Your daughter, nothing if not a reasonable preschooler, drops her resentment. "Of course, Daddy," she says sweetly, because a cue associated with the previously pleasurable experience triggers a surge of dopamine in the NA and incites consummatory behavior. "Seeing my candy bar was your cue, and eating it was the consummatory behavior. You have such a silly, predictable reinforcement system." "Wow," you say. "That's exactly right, honey. Will you share that last piece of chocolate with me?" "No way! Your dopamine circuits aren't my problem." Environmental cues associated with drug use, paraphernalia, people, places, and situations are all powerful triggers for repeated use and for relapse because they themselves trigger dopamine release. People trying to quit smoking, for example, are advised to avoid poker if they are used to having a cigarette while playing cards. Unless they move to a different area of town or to a recovery home, my downtown East Side patients find it virtually impossible to stop drug use even when they form a strong intention to do so. Not only are drugs readily available, but everything and everyone in the environment reminds them of their habit. Reinforcement is important in all addictions, drug-related or not. In my own case, it doesn't help matters that the Portland Hotel is located within a few blocks of those unscrupulous compact disc pushers at Sikora's, my favorite music haunt, and that I drive by there most days on my way to or from work. As I described earlier, I can feel excitement rising as I approach the store, even when I have no plan to go there, along with an urge to park the car and walk in. In my nucleus accumbens, the dopamine is flowing. The incentive is powerful. Needless to say, life essential reinforcers such as food and sex trigger VTA activation and dopamine release in the NA, since the performance of survival-related behaviors is the very purpose of the incentive motivation system. Accordingly, this system is decisive in initiating activities such as foraging for food and other life-sustaining necessities, seeking sexual partners, and exploring the environment. The VTA and NA and their connections with other brain circuits are also active when we explore novel objects and situations and evaluate them in light of previous reinforcing experiences. In other words, nerve fibers in the VTA are triggering dopamine release in the NA when a person needs to know, is this new whatever it is going to help me or hurt me? Will I like it or not? The role of the dopamine system in novelty seeking helps explain why some people are driven to risky behaviors such as street racing. It's one way to experience the excitement of dopamine release. Dopamine activity also accounts for a curious fact reported by many drug addicts, that obtaining and preparing the substance gives them a rush quite apart from the pharmaceutical effects that follow drug injection. When I draw up the syringe, wrap the tie, and clean my arm, it's like I'm already feeling a hit, Celia, the pregnant woman described in Chapter 6, once told me. Many addicts confess that they're as afraid of giving up the activities around drug use as they are of giving up the drugs themselves. It is fascinating to look at some of the evidence linking the dopamine system to addictions. Animal experiments, distressing as they sometimes are to read about, can be stunning for their scientific ingenuity and technical expertise. Just how important dopamine receptors are to substance use was illustrated by a study of mice who had previously been trained to drink alcohol. They were given an infusion of dopamine receptors right into the nucleus accumbens. Before the infusion, these rodents had fewer than normal dopamine receptors. The receptors were incorporated into a harmless virus that entered the animal's brain cells so that temporarily a normal range of receptor activity was achieved. As long as this artificial supply of dopamine receptors was available, the mice reduced their alcohol intake considerably. But they gradually became boozers again as the implanted receptors were lost to natural attrition. Why is this relevant? First, as I've already explained, chronic cocaine use reduces the number of dopamine receptors, and thereby keeps driving the addict to use the drug simply to make up for the loss of dopamine activity. No wonder Lisa ended up with syphilis contracted in a back alley encounter. That was her way of obtaining the substance the incentive circuits in her brain were screaming for. If she'd only had a nicotine addiction, she could have purchased a drug supplied by respectable manufacturers and dealers. Dopamine receptor availability is also reduced in alcoholics, as well as in heroin and crystal meth addicts. More importantly, research now strongly suggests that the existence of relatively few dopamine receptors to begin with may be one of the biological bases of addictive behaviors. When our natural incentive motivation system is impaired, addiction is one of the likely consequences. But why would some creatures, human or non-human, have relatively few dopamine receptors? Why, in other words, would their natural incentive system be under-functioning? I will soon present the evidence to show that such lacks are not random occurrences, but have predictable and preventable causes. As we have now seen, addiction inevitably involves both opioid and dopamine circuitry. The dopamine system is most active during the initiation and establishment of drug intake and other addictive behaviors. It is key to the reinforcing patterns of all drugs of abuse: alcohol, stimulants, opioids, nicotine, and cannabis. Desire, wanting, and craving are all incentive feelings, so it is easy to see why dopamine is central to non-drug-related addictions too. On the other hand, opioids, innate or external, are more responsible for the pleasure-reward aspects of addiction. Opioid circuits and dopamine pathways are important components of what has been called the limbic system, or the emotional brain. The circuits of the limbic system process emotions like love, joy, pleasure, pain, anger, and fear. For all their complexities, emotions exist for a very basic purpose: to initiate and maintain activities necessary for survival. In a nutshell, they modulate two drives that are absolutely essential to animal life, including human life: attachment and aversion. We always want to move towards something that is positive, inviting, and nurturing, and to repel or withdraw from something threatening, distasteful, or toxic. These attachment and aversion emotions are evoked by both physical and psychological stimuli, and when properly developed, our emotional brain is an unerring, reliable guide to life. It facilitates self-protection and also makes possible love, compassion, and healthy social interaction. When impaired or confused, as it often is in the complex and stressed circumstances prevailing in our civilized society, the emotional brain leads us to nothing but trouble. Addiction is one of its chief dysfunctions. Chapter 16. Like a Child Not Released. Yesterday, Claire sat in the hall area outside my office and howled bloody murder at the other patients awaiting their turns. And when I opened the door to let someone in, she aimed her invective at me.
"You're not a doctor, you're the fucking mafia,"
was among the milder of the insults she hurled my way. There was no appeasing her. Kim, the Portland nurse, finally warned Claire that we'd call the police if she didn't leave off immediately. Sobbing, she made her way out the back door to the Portland's upper courtyard. At every step or two, she would turn around and scream hellishly at no one in particular, each epithet punctuated by a shower of spittle that sprayed from between her decayed teeth. That's how Claire acts when she goes over to the dark side. She's one of the Portland's most challenging personalities. New staff are instructed never to let her into the reception office, no matter how positive she seems. One of her most recent borderline episodes counted a printer and the front desk phone system among its wounded. Much of the time she ambles around like an overgrown child, craving love.
"Dr. Mate, where's my hug?"
she'll shout, running after me in the street. It's not personal to me. She begs for the same affection from Kim and many other Portland staff who have shown her kindness in the past. Her need for endorphins is as insatiable as is her need for the dopamine hits she gets from cocaine. Today she's come to see me for a medical problem, and we are calmly discussing the previous day's events. "I can treat you in one of two ways," I say. "Like a totally mentally ill person who's not responsible for what she does, or I can treat you like you're not a mentally ill person, which is how I do try to relate to you. In that case, you are responsible for what you do. Which do you prefer?" "I don't know how to answer that." Claire smiles ruefully. "Claire, it's not acceptable that you yell insults at me. It's not like anything even happened, or whatever happened, happened in your mind, not in real life. You were screaming at me and at a whole bunch of other people who had as much right to see me as you did." Claire bows her head. "I know, but I still don't know how to answer that." "Was it cocaine?" "Probably, I don't know." That means yes. My voice loses some of its edge. "I really don't think you're in control when you're that way," I say. "I don't believe you're doing it deliberately." Claire lifts her eyes to look straight at me. "Of course not," she says quietly. "But what you do deliberately is that you use cocaine." "Because I'm addicted to it." "That's a choice you're making," I reply. Even as the words leave my lips, I know I'm mouthing a platitude. From a certain point of view, everything we do is a choice. From a scientific perspective, though, Claire is closer to the mark. Her explanation that she is addicted, and that therefore her drug use is not the result of thoughtful deliberation, fits with the research evidence. It sounds like a cop-out, but in neurological terms, it's not. Recent studies have shown that repeated drug use leads to long-lasting changes in the brain that undermine voluntary control, says an article co-written by Dr. Nora Volkow, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Although initial drug experimentation and recreational use may be volitional, once addiction develops, this control is markedly disrupted. In other words, drug addiction damages the parts of the brain responsible for decision-making. We've already seen that the brain circuits of motivation and of reward are recruited to serve addictive behaviors. In this chapter, we'll consider scientific evidence suggesting that addiction also disrupts the self-regulation circuits, which the addict needs in order to choose not to be an addict. We know which brain area controls actions like, say, the rotation of the thumb. If that area of the cortex is destroyed, the thumb doesn't move. The same principle applies to formulating decisions and regulating impulses. They too are governed by specific brain circuits and systems, but in a much more complex and interactive fashion than simple physical movements. As with motor activities, we've discovered which parts of the brain are responsible for volition and choice by studying people whose brains have been injured. When certain brain areas are damaged, there are predictable patterns of impaired rational decision-making and diminished impulse regulation. Brain imaging studies and psychological testing indicate that the same areas are also impaired in drug addiction. And what is the result? If it wasn't enough that powerful incentive and reward mechanisms drive the craving for drugs, on top of that, the circuits that could normally inhibit and control those mechanisms are not up to their task. In fact, they are complicit in the addiction process. A double whammy. The watchman is aiding the thieves. To understand how this works, we need another glimpse at brain anatomy and physiology. The human brain is the most complex biological entity in the universe. It has between 80 billion and 100 billion nerve cells, or neurons, each branched to form thousands of possible connections with other nerve cells. In addition, there are a trillion support cells, called glia, that help the neurons thrive and function. Laid end to end, the nerve cables of a single human brain would create a line several hundred thousand miles long. The total number of connections or synapses is in the incalculable trillions. The parallel and simultaneous activity of innumerable brain circuits and networks of circuits produces millions of firing patterns every second of our lives. It's no wonder the brain has been described as a supersystem of systems. In general, the higher in the brain we ascend physically, the more recent are the brain centers in evolutionary development and the more complex their functions. In the brainstem, automatic functions such as breathing and body temperature are regulated. The emotional circuits are higher up, and at the very top surface of the brain is the cortex or gray matter. None of these areas works on its own. All are in constant communication with other circuits near and far, and all are influenced by chemical messengers from elsewhere in the body and brain. As a human being matures, higher brain systems come to exert some control over the lower ones. Cortex means bark, and the multi-layered cerebral cortex envelops the rest of the brain like the bark of a tree. About the size and thickness of a table napkin, it contains the cell bodies of neurons organized into many essential centers, each with highly specialized functions. The visual cortex, for example, is in the occipital lobe at the back of the brain. If it sustains damage, as in the case of a stroke, vision is lost. The most recently evolved part of the cortex, distinguishing us from other animals, is the prefrontal cortex, the gray matter area in the front of the brain. It's a simplification, but an accurate one, to say that the frontal cortex, and particularly its prefrontal portions, acts as the chief executive officer of the brain. It is here that alternatives are weighed and choices considered. It is also here that emotionally driven impulses to act are evaluated and either given permission to go ahead or, if necessary, inhibited. One of the most important duties of the cortex is to inhibit inappropriate response rather than to produce the appropriate one, suggests neuropsychologist Joseph Ledoux. The prefrontal cortex, PFC, writes psychiatrist Jeffrey Schwartz, plays a central role in the seemingly free selection of behaviors by inhibiting many of the alternative responses that arise in a situation, allowing only one to proceed. It makes sense, then, that when this region is damaged, patients become unable to stifle inappropriate responses to their environment. In other words, people with impaired PFC function will have poor impulse control and will behave in ways that to others seem uncalled for, childish, or bizarre. It is also in the frontal cortex that social behaviors are learned. When the executive parts of the cortex have been destroyed in rats, they are still able to function, but only as immature youngsters who haven't acquired any social skills. They are impulsive, aggressive, and sexually inappropriate. They behave very much like rats reared in isolation, with no access to social play and other interactions. Monkeys injured in the area of the right prefrontal cortex lose interactive skills such as the reading of emotional cues and the mutual grooming necessary for normal social contact. They soon come to be ostracized by their fellows. Human beings with prefrontal injuries also lose many of their social capacities. Here in the prefrontal cortex, important nerve systems are implicated in addiction. The executive functions of the prefrontal cortex are not restricted to any one area, and its proper workings depend on healthy connections and input from the emotional or limbic centers in lower parts of the brain. Conversely, dysfunction in the cortex helps to facilitate addictive behavior. We'll now look at one particular prefrontal segment to understand how this happens. Many studies link addiction to the orbitofrontal cortex, OFC, a cortical segment found near the eye socket, or orbit. In drug addicts, whether they are intoxicated or not, it doesn't function normally. The OFC's relationship with addiction arises from its special role in human behavior and from its abundant supply of opioid and dopamine receptors. It is powerfully affected by drugs and powerfully reinforces the drug habit. It also plays an essential supporting role in non-drug addictions. Of course, it doesn't function or malfunction on its own, but forms part of an extensive and incredibly complex, multifaceted network. Nor is it the only cortical area implicated in addiction. Through its rich connections with the limbic emotional centers, the OFC is the apex of the emotional brain and serves as its mission control room. In normal circumstances in a mature human being, the OFC is among the highest arbiters of our emotional lives. It receives input from all the sensory areas, which allows it to process environmental data such as vision, touch, taste, smell, and sound. Why is that important? Because it's the OFC's job to evaluate the nature and potential value of stimuli based on present information, but also in light of previous experience. The neurological traces of early formative events are embedded in the OFC, which in turn is connected with other memory-serving brain structures. So, for example, a smell that in early memory is associated with a pleasurable experience will likely be judged by the OFC in a positive way. Through its access to memory traces, conscious and unconscious, the OFC decides the emotional value of stimuli. For example, are we intensely drawn to or repelled by a person or object or activity, or are we neutral? It is constantly surveying the emotional significance of situations, their personal meaning to the individual. Through processes we are not consciously aware of, in microseconds, the OFC decides our take on people or on a situation. Since our likes and dislikes preferences and aversions strongly influence what we focus on. The OFC helps us to decide to what or whom we should devote our attention at any given moment. The OFC, particularly on the right side of the brain, has a unique influence on social and emotional behaviors, including attachment, love relationships. It is deeply concerned with the assessment of interactions between the self and others, and plays a ceaseless but fundamentally life-essential game of who loves me, who loves me not. It even gauges how much does he or she love me or dislike me. While the explicit meanings of words spoken are decoded in specialized portions of the left hemisphere, the right OFC interprets the emotional content of communications, the other person's body language, eye movements, and tone of voice. One cue the OFC watches for is the size of the other's pupils. In social interactions, especially in eyes set in a smiling face, dilated pupils mean enjoyment and delight. Babies are highly sensitive to such cues, as are aphasiac adults, people who, usually due to a stroke, have lost the ability to understand spoken language. Because they pay heed to physical, emotional, rather than verbal messages, young children and aphasiacs have a much better sense of when they are being lied to than most of us. These split-second analytic functions are unconscious. As in the old Mother Goose rhyme, we may be aware of the results, but not of the process. I do not like thee, Dr. Fell. The reason why, I cannot tell. But this I know, and know full well, I do not like thee, Dr. Fell. In actual fact, the poor Dr. Fell victim to the anonymous poet's orbitofrontal cortex, or, at the risk of completely alienating readers who aren't fond of word plays, Dr. Fell had a hard day at the OFC. The OFC also contributes to decision-making and to inhibiting impulses that, if allowed to be acted out, would be harmful, for example, inappropriate anger or violence. Finally, brain researchers have also linked the orbitofrontal cortex to our capacity to balance short-term objectives against longer-term consequences in the process of decision-making. Imaging studies consistently indicate that the OFC works abnormally in drug abusers, showing malfunctioning patterns in blood flow, energy use, and activation. No wonder, then, that psychological testing shows drug addicts to be prone to maladaptive decisions when faced with short-term versus long-term outcomes, especially under conditions that involve risk and uncertainty. Due to their poorly regulated brain systems, including the OFC, they seem programmed to accept short-term gain, for example, the drug high, at the risk of long-term pain, disease, personal loss, legal troubles, and so on. A regular finding of brain imaging studies on drug addicts is underactivity of the OFC after detoxification. In a similar vein, psychological testing of cocaine addicts has shown impaired decision-making. In one study, some key aspects of their decision-making ability was a mere 50% of normal. Only people with physical injury to the frontal cortex would score lower. It may seem paradoxical, but the OFC is also highly activated during craving, not to enhance decision-making, but to initiate craving itself. It turns out that different parts of the OFC have different functions. One part is involved in decision-making, another in the automatic and emotional aspects of craving. In imaging studies, the OFC lights up when an addict so much as thinks about her drug. An abnormally functioning OFC has also been implicated in compulsive behaviors in both human and animal studies. A rat with a damaged orbitofrontal cortex will persevere in reward-seeking, addiction-type activities even after the rewards are removed. As the researchers comment, these findings are reminiscent of the reports of drug addicts who claim that once they start taking a drug of abuse, they cannot stop, even when the drug is no longer pleasurable. If we consider the likelihood that Claire's apparatus for rational judgment and impulse control, including prominently the OFC, is impaired, we can begin to understand her aggressive behavior the day before and also appreciate her argument that she does not deliberately use cocaine. With a malfunctioning OFC, she has little impulse inhibition. Instead, she carries immense, chaotic, ever-seething rage in her body and brain. Claire was raped repeatedly by her father over many years, while her mother either didn't notice or looked away. Based on her history, it's certain that Claire also suffered psychological and physical abandonment almost from the moment of her birth. The emotional traces of those events are encoded in nerve patterns in her OFC, and that includes experiences she cannot consciously recall. The brain structures for conscious recall develop during the first years of life, and aspects of the implicit memory system, which stores emotional memories, are present at birth. And if they are present then, they likely existed before as well. Cocaine disinhibits aggression. With little impulse control to begin with, under the influence of the drug, Claire can become a rage machine, automatic, autonomic, and at such moments, virtually without conscious will. But what about the choice I said she had when I was talking with her in my office, the choice to use cocaine the day before in the first place? Let's consider that question from the perspective of brain activity. It is not hyperbole to say that drugs have been the chief source of consolation that Claire, now in her 30s, has ever found. Ever since she began using in adolescence, they've offered her relief from searing emotional pain, loneliness, anxiety, and a deep-seated fear of the world. As a result, her OFC has been trained to create a powerful emotional pull toward the drug from the second she even thinks about fixing. Addiction research refers to this dynamic as salience attribution, the assignment of great value to a false need, and the depreciation of true ones. It occurs unconsciously and automatically. We can now reconstruct yesterday's events. When Claire sees the plastic bag with the white cocaine powder, the needle and the syringe, or when she so much as thinks about them, her brain will respond in a highly positive way. Owing to the OFC's influence on the incentive centers described in the last chapter, dopamine will start flowing in Claire's midbrain circuits. This causes the craving for the drug to intensify. Any thoughts of negative consequences are thrust aside. The part of the OFC that might speak up to warn her of these consequences is gagged and bound. Thus, Claire's OFC, impaired by years of drug use, and perhaps even before then, encourages the self-harming activity rather than inhibiting it. She injects. 10 minutes later, she takes her seat outside my office. Someone says the wrong thing, or she believes they do. Her OFC, unconsciously primed to recall the many times she has been attacked, insulted, and injured, interprets this stimulus as a serious aggression. Claire is triggered. According to PET scans, the OFC distinguishes and reacts to angry, disgusted, and fearful facial expressions in other people, but not to neutral facial expressions. Literally, all the offending person had to do was to look at Claire the wrong way. After reading this description, you may think that I believe drug addicts bear no responsibility for their actions and have no choices. That is not my view, as I will explain later. I hope it's clear, however, that in the real world, choice, will, and responsibility are not absolute and unambiguous concepts. People choose, decide, and act in a context, and to a large degree, that context is determined by how their brains function. The brain itself also develops in the real world, influenced by conditions over which the individual, as a young child, had no choice whatsoever. In this chapter, we have seen that the orbitofrontal cortex, a central part of the brain system that regulates how we process our emotions and how we react to them, participates in substance dependence in a number of ways. First, it emotionally overvalues